Eh? It's, like, really expensive, though.
Like what? $100?
No. Like $1,000.
A year?
A night.
You're kidding.
No, for real. It's, like, really exclusive.
Really? I didn't think this was going to get past the accounting office, but I was in a reckless mood. How do I get to the point?
Stop beating around the bush.
She laughed hard and slapped the counter.
Got ya.
Hey, you're good. What did I do to deserve this? Max got herself under control.
Hey, you really going there?
Why not? I have a rich uncle.
You must. You rich?
I'm John. She giggled politely.
Good one.
Max handed me a map, which I noticed had lots of thin, winding roads that ran through open spaces, with very few towns. I thought of Harry, who liked the Adirondacks, and I asked God to do the right thing this time. Max put an X on the map.
The point is on Upper Saranac Lake. About there. You should call for directions. Also, you have to call for reservations.
They're, like, always booked. At $1,000 a night?
Yeah, can you believe?
She pulled a phone book from under the counter, found the number of the point, and wrote it on the map, saying to me, "You won't find a brochure on this place in the wire rack." Really? I put the map in my pocket, and Max said to me,
"So, you're from New York City?"
I am.
I love New York. So what brings you up here?
A helicopter. She started to smile, then a little light went off in her head, and she said,
"Oh, you're the guy who flew in on the FBI helicopter."
Right. Fuller Brush Incorporated. She laughed.
No.
FBI. Like Federal Bureau of Investigation. Kate appeared, carrying two containers of coffee, and asked me,
"You having a good time here?"
"I'm renting a car."
I could hear you laughing from the restaurant. What's the joke?
What's the point? Max laughed. Kate did not. I said, "It's a long story."
"Shorten it."
"Okay. There's this place. A hotel or something."
"A resort,"
said Max helpfully. "Right. A resort called The Point." So Max, that's this young lady, no, first I asked, "Is there a good place to stay?" So she says, "What's the point?"
"No,"
interrupted Max. "I said, the point, and you said, what's the point?" And I said,
"All right," Kate interrupted. "I get it."
She put my coffee on the counter.
"At what point are we now?"
I replied professionally, "I was just about to identify myself as a federal agent." Kate beat me to it and showed her credentials. She said to Max,
"I need photocopies of all car rental contracts from Thursday to now, including vehicles that have been returned. See if you can do that in 10 minutes. We'll be in the restaurant."
Kate went to the next counter, Enterprise Rent-A-Car, and spoke to the young man there. I said to Max, "That's my wife."
"Gee, I never would have guessed."
I took the coffee and went into the restaurant, which was actually just a small cafe. The walls and ceilings were painted a horrid sky blue, complete with white clouds unlike any I've ever seen on this planet. Plastic models of biplanes hung from the ceiling, and photos of various aircraft added to the motif. There was a 4-stool lunch counter, which was empty, and a dozen empty tables from which I could choose. I sat at a table near a picture window where I could see the runway. An attractive waitress came over with a menu and asked,
"And how are you this afternoon?"
"Great. I'm happily married. Can I have another menu?" "My wife will be here in a few minutes."
"Sure."
She put the menu down and moved off to get another one. My cell phone rang and the caller ID said private, which 90% of the time is the office, so I let it go into voicemail. Kate came into the cafe and said,
"My cell phone just rang."
Probably Bergdorf's looking for you. She sat down and listened to her voicemail.
Tom Walsh wants me to call.
Wait a few minutes.
All right.
She took the sheaf of Commute Air printouts from her briefcase and laid them on the table. I took half and started flipping through them while dialing my cell phone.
Who are you calling?
The Point. A man named Charles answered, and I said, I'd like to make a reservation for this evening.
Yes, sir. We have some availability.
Do you also have rooms?
Yes, sir.
We have the Mohawk Room in the main lodge, the Lookout in the Eagle's Nest, the Weather Watch in the guest house. Slow down, Charles. What can I get for $1,000?
Nothing.
Nothing? Not even a cot in the kitchen? He quoted me some rates on the available rooms, and I got scalped by the Mohawk for $1,200, which was the cheapest room available. I asked him, does this place have heat and electricity?
Yes, sir.
How many nights will you be staying with us? I'm not sure, Charles. Let's start with two.
Yes, sir.
He added, if you're with us on Wednesday evening, black tie is requested for dinner. Are you telling me I need a tuxedo to eat dinner in the woods?
Yes, sir.
He explained, William Avery Rockefeller, who owned this property, would dine with his guests each evening in black tie. We try to recreate the experience on Wednesday and Saturday evenings. I might need to miss that experience. Can I get room service in my underwear?
Yes, sir.
How would you like to secure the reservation? I gave him my name and government credit card. We ironed out a few other details, and I asked him, you have any bears there?
Yes, sir.
We have a bar in the... Bears, Charles. Bears. You know, Ursus Terribilis. There are bears in the area, but... Feed the bears tonight, Charles. See you later. I hung up. Kate said,
did I hear you correctly?
Yeah. Fucking bears.
The room rate.
Yeah, we're in the Mohawk Room. The weather watch at $2,000 a night seemed a little extravagant.
Are you crazy?
Why do you ask? Hey, after two nights in that B&B hovel you booked, we deserve a nice place.
I think we get an allowance of $100 per diem in the Albany area.
She reminded me,
You have to make up the difference.
We'll see. Kate's beeper went off and she looked at it.
Tom.
Give it a few more minutes.
Maybe they've found Harry.
That would be nice. I flipped through the printouts, trying to see if anything stuck out. Kate, too, went through the printouts and said,
here is the 11 a.m. commute air from Boston on Saturday.
Wow. Wow, what?
Edward Wolfer. You know who he is?
Yeah, he played center field for the...
He's the Deputy Secretary of Defense.
Very hawkish guy, pushing for the war in Iraq.
Very close to the president. He's on TV a lot.
That's probably the guy who someone here recognized.
Yes, and here's another one on the same flight. Paul Dunn. He's a presidential advisor
on matters of national security and a member of the National Security Council.
Right. How did you know that?
It's always a Jeopardy question.
Why do you like to play stupid?
It's a good cover for when I really am stupid. I said, so Wolfer and Dunn arrived Saturday, plus two other guys, according to Betty, and they all got into the van to the Custer Hill Club. Kate looked again at the passenger manifest for the 11 a.m. Saturday flight from Boston and said,
there were nine other men on that flight, but none of these other names rings a bell. So we don't know who these other two guys were who got into the van.
Right. I continued flipping through the passenger lists. Wolfer and Dunn left on the first Boston flight yesterday, connecting to Washington. She nodded thoughtfully, then asked me,
does this mean anything?
Well, on the surface, it doesn't mean much. A lot of rich and powerful guys got together on a 3-day weekend at a mountain lodge owned by an oil billionaire. It's like one of those Renaissance weekends, or a gathering of the Carlyle Group, where some people and the media speculate that all kinds of devious things are going on. Oil price rigging, financial and political deals, conspiracies to take over the planet and that kind of thing. But sometimes it's just a bunch of rich guys getting together to relax, play cards, talk about women, and tell dirty jokes. Kate thought about that. "Sometimes it is," she said. "But someone in the Justice Department ordered a surveillance of this gathering. That's the point." She went on, "And it's not every day that the Justice Department wants to keep an eye on the Deputy Secretary of Defense, a presidential advisor, and who knows who else in this club." I commented, "This is getting good." I scanned the passenger manifests. "We need to do a background check of everyone who arrived here by commercial aircraft in the last few days, and see what, if any, connection they have to one another. Then try to find out what Harry was supposed to find out on his surveillance. Who went from here to the Custer Hill Club?" Kate replied, "I don't think that's our job. Tom didn't mention that." It's good to show initiative. Tom appreciates that. And by the way, fuck Tom. The waitress came by, and one of us ordered a double bacon cheeseburger, and the other ordered a Cobb salad. Whatever the hell that is. My beeper went off, and I looked at the number. Not surprisingly, it was Tom Walsh. "I'll call him." "No, I'll call him," Kate said. "Let me handle this. He likes and respects me." I dialed Tom's cell phone, and he answered. I asked, "Did you page me?" "Yes, I paged you. And Kate. And I called you both. You were supposed to call me when you landed." "We just got in. Headwinds. According to the pilot, you've been there almost an hour." There was a long line at the car rental. "More important, what's the word on Harry?" "Nothing yet." He briefed me on nothing, then said, "I want you to drive to the regional headquarters of the state police in Raybrook. That's a few miles from Saranac Lake. Make contact with a Major Hank Schaefer, commander of B Troop, and coordinate the search operation with him. You can offer your services and expertise, such as they are, and offer to participate in the search." "Okay. That's it?" "For now. Meanwhile, we're going through channels to see if we can get a few hundred troops from Fort Drum to participate in the search. That will speed it up considerably. Tell Schaefer we're still working on that."
"Will do. Call me when you've spoken to Schaefer."
"Will do.
Okay, is Kate there?"
"She's in the ladies' room."
"Tell her to call me."
"Will do.
What are you doing now?"
"Waiting for a double bacon cheeseburger."
"Okay.
Don't hang around the airport too long, and don't ask anyone there any questions."
"What do you mean?"
"Just get over to the state trooper headquarters ASAP. And don't even think about going to the Custer..."
"I understand."
"All right. Nothing further." I hung up, and Kate asked me,
"What did he say?"
I sipped my coffee and went back to the printouts. "He wants us to go to the Custer Hill Club and see if Bane Maddox is there, and talk to him, and see who else is there."
"He said that?"
"Not in so many words."
"Did he want me to call him?"
"At your convenience." She was getting a little impatient with me and said, "John, what the fuck did he—" "Here's the deal. Nothing new on Harry. Walsh wants us to make contact with the state police, help in the search, and not snoop around the airport." I noted, "Too late for that."
"I didn't hear anything about going to the Custer Hill Club."
"Why don't you go see the state police?"
"I'll go to the Custer Hill Club."
She didn't reply. I said to her, "Kate, we were sent here as a pro forma response to the disappearance of one of our guys from the task force. We're here to get the bad news, or the good news, if and when Harry is found. This is just protocol. You know that. The question for you is, do you want to take a reactive or proactive role here?"
"You have a way of putting things. Let me think about it."
"Do that." The food came, and the double bacon cheeseburger looked like it could give you a heart attack if you touched it. The Freedom Fries had a little American flag stuck in them. Kate asked, "Do you want some of this salad?" I found a slug in a salad once.
"Thanks."
Before I could get my minimum daily requirement of fat, the guy from Enterprise came into the cafe and handed Kate a stack of photostated car rental contracts. He said to her, "I get off duty at 4 if you want me to show you around. Maybe we can have dinner." I put my cell phone number on my card.
"Thanks, Larry. I'll call you later."
He left. I said, "You put him up to that."
"What are you talking about?"
I didn't reply and called for the check so we could get moving as soon as Max showed up. I took another bite of my cheeseburger, and Max came into the cafe, spotted us, and came over. She said to Kate,
"Here's all the contracts from Thursday to tomorrow, including returns. There's like 26. It's a big weekend."
Kate replied,
"Thank you. And please don't mention this to anyone."
"Sure."
She looked at me and said, "You're a lucky guy to have a wife like this."
My mouth was full of burger, and I grunted. Max left, and I swallowed. "You put her up to that."
"What are you talking about?"
I shoved some Freedom Fries in my mouth, stood, and said, "Okay, let's go." Kate put the papers in a briefcase. I put $20 on the table, and we left the cafe. I said, "If you're not coming with me, go to Hertz and get yourself another car. The state police headquarters is in some place called Raybrook, not far from here. Ask for Major Schaefer. I'll call you later." She stood there, wavering between following Walsh's orders and her recently expressed opinion to him that the world had changed. Finally, she said, "I'll go with you to the Custer Hill Club. Then, we go to the state police headquarters." We exited the terminal, walked to the car rental lot, and found the blue Taurus. I drove to the side of the terminal building where the general aviation operations were and parked the car. I want to see if GoCo has a corporate jet and if they use this airport. I handed her the road map and said, "Call the county police and see if you can get directions to the Custer Hill Club." I went into the building where a guy sat at a desk behind the counter playing with his computer. I asked him, "Can I get a ticket to Paris here?" He looked up from his computer and replied, "You can go anywhere you want if you own, lease, or charter a plane big enough. And you don't even need a ticket." I think I'm in the right place. I held up my credentials and said, "John Corey, Federal Anti-Terrorist Task Force. I need to ask you a few questions." He stood, came to the counter, and checked out the creds. "What's up?" he asked. "Who am I talking to?"
"I'm Chad Rickman, operations officer."
"Okay, Chad. I need to know if there's a private jet that uses this airport, registered to the Global Oil Corporation. GoCo."
"Yeah? 2 Cessna Citations. New models."
"Any problem?" "Are either of the jets here?"
"No. In fact, they both came in yesterday morning, about an hour apart. Fueled up, then a few hours later they took off."
"How many passengers got off?"
"I don't think there were any. We usually send a car out to the aircraft, and I'm pretty sure it was just the flight crew."
"Did any passengers get on after they refueled?"
"I don't think so. They came in, topped off, and a few hours later they flew out."
"All right. Where did they go?"
"They don't have to tell me where they're going. They have to tell the FAA.
"Okay. How do they tell the FAA? Radio?"
"No. Phone. From here. Actually, I overheard both pilots filing a flight plan to Kansas City, departing 30 minutes apart."
I thought about that, then asked, "Why would they be going to Kansas City with no one on board?"
"Maybe they only had cargo," Chad replied. "I remember 2 jeeps met them here and put some stuff on board."
"What did they put on board?"
"I didn't see."
"These are passenger planes, right? Not cargo?"
"Right. But they'll hold a little cargo in the cabin.
I still don't understand why two jets flew in empty and flew out with a few pieces of cargo, both of them going to the same place.
Hey, this guy who owns the planes, Bain Maddox, owns the fucking oil wells. He can burn all the jet fuel he wants.
This is true. I asked, was Kansas City their final destination?
I don't know. That's the flight plan I heard them file on the telephone. That's probably about their cruising range, so maybe they're going on from there. Or maybe they're coming back here.
I see. So I can call the FAA to get their flight plans?
Yeah, if you're authorized, and if you have their tail registration numbers.
Well, I'm authorized, Chad. I pulled out the sheet of paper that Randy had fetched from this office and put it on the desk. Which are the GOCO aircraft? He studied the sheet and checked off two numbers, N2730G and N2731G. Chad informed me, sequential registration numbers. A lot of companies that fly their own airplanes do that.
I know that.
Yeah? What's up?
Typical tax crap. The rich are different from you and me.
No kidding.
Okay, thanks, Chad. Think more about this. Ask around for me and see if anyone else remembers anything.
You got a cell phone number?
Sure.
He wrote it on his business card and asked me, what exactly are you looking for?
I told you. Tax evasion. Bags of money.
I said to him, don't mention anything to anyone about a federal investigation.
Mum's the word.
I left the operations office and got back in the car. I said to Kate, there are two GOCO corporate jets that use this airport. I filled her in as I drove toward the airport exit and told her that we'd have to call the FAA office in Washington to find out what continuing flight plans had been filed for those two jets. Kate asked me, why do we want to know that?
I don't know yet.
This guy Maddox interests me, and you never know what's important until you piece it together with something else. In detective work, there's no such thing as TMI. Too much information.
Should I be taking notes?
No, I'll give you one of my taped lectures that I gave at John Jay.
Thank you.
At the airport exit, I asked Kate, did you get directions?
Sort of. The desk sergeant said take Route 3 West to 56 North, then ask around.
Real men don't ask directions. I asked, which way is Route 3?
Well, if you're asking, turn left.
Within a few minutes, we were on Route 3, designated a scenic highway, heading west into the wilderness. I said to Kate, keep an eye out for bears.
Hey, do you think a 9mm Glock will stop a bear?
I don't think so. But I hope to God you get to find out.
That's not very loving.
She sat back in her seat and closed her eyes.
Every minute that goes by without word about Harry makes me think he's not alive.
I didn't reply. She stayed silent a while, then said, it could have been you.
It could have been. But if it were me out in the woods around the Custer Hill Club, things may have turned out differently.
Then again, maybe not.
Chapter 21. We continued west on Route 3, a road that seemed to have no reason to exist, except to look at trees while you went from nowhere to nowhere. Kate had picked up a few brochures from the airport and was perusing them. She does this wherever we go so she can enhance her experience. Then, she regurgitates this stuff back to me, like a tour guide. She informed me that Saranac Lake, the town and the airport and this road, was actually within the boundaries of Adirondack State Park. She also informed me that this area was known as the North Country, a name she found romantic. I commented,
You could freeze to death here in April. She went on, large parts of the park have been designated as forever wild. That's pretty depressing. The area designated as parkland is as big as the state of New Hampshire. What's New Hampshire? Much of it is uninhabited. That's fairly obvious. And so forth. Actually, I could see now how someone could be lost in here for days or weeks, or the rest of their lives. But I also realized that someone could survive if they had some experience in the woods. Route 3 was actually a decent two-lane road that occasionally passed through a small town. But there were stretches of wilderness that aroused my agoraphobia and zoophobia. I could see why this guy Bane Maddox would have a lodge up here if he were up to no good. Kate said, "This is so beautiful." It is. It sucked. There were yellow signs with black silhouettes of jumping deer, which I guess were to warn the deer to jump out of the way of cars on the road. Around a turn was a big sign that had a black painting of a bear and the word caution. I said, "Did you see that? Did you see that bear sign?" "Yes. That means there are bears in the area." "Holy shit. Are the doors locked?" "John, stop being an idiot. Bears won't bother you if you don't bother them." Famous last words. How do you know what bothers a bear? Stop with the fucking bears. We continued on. There wasn't much traffic going our way, and only a few vehicles passed us going back towards Saranac Lake. Kate said, "Tell me why we're going to the Custer Hill Club." Standard police procedure. You go to the place where you last heard from the missing subject. This is a little more complex than a missing person case. Actually, it isn't. The problem with the FBI and the CIA is that they make things more complicated than they need to be.
Is that a fact?
Yes, it is.
I need to remind you that we don't want to alert Maddox or anyone there that a federal agent was on his property.
I think we've discussed this. If you were on the Custer Hill property with a broken leg, no cell phone service, and a bear nibbling on your toes, would you want me to follow orders and wait for a search warrant to look for you? She considered that, then said, "I know that a cop will risk his life and his career to help another cop. And I know you'd do the same for me. Though you may be conflicted about my dual role as your wife and as an FBI agent." Interesting point.
"But I think you have another agenda, which is to see what the Custer Hill Club is all about."
"What was your first clue?"
"Well, the stack of airline passenger lists and car rental contracts in my briefcase, for one. And you inquiring about Global Oil Corporation aircraft, for another.
I just can't seem to fool you."
"John, I agree that we need to push the search for Harry. But beyond that, you're getting into something that may be a lot bigger than you realize."
She reminded me, then added, "The Justice Department is interested in this man and this club and his guests. Do not screw up their investigation." "Are you speaking as my colleague, my wife, or my lawyer?"
"All of the above."
She paused for a moment, then added,
"Okay, I've said my piece because I had to say it and because I really worry about you sometimes. You're a loose cannon."
"Thank you."
"You're also extremely bright and clever, and I trust your judgment and your instincts."
"Really?"
"Really. So even though I'm technically your superior, I'll follow your lead on this."
"I won't let you down."
"You'd better not.
And I also want to remind you that nothing succeeds like success. If you, we, go beyond our orders, then we'd better have something to show for it." "Kate, if I didn't think there was more to this than oil price rigging, we'd be sitting around the state trooper headquarters now, drinking coffee." She took my hand, and we drove on. About 40 minutes after we'd left the airport, I saw a sign for Route 56 North, and Kate said,
"Bear right."
I hit the brakes and reached for my Glock. "Where?"
"Here. Bear right. Go."
"Bear? Oh. Bear right. Don't use that word. Turn fucking right. Here. I turned onto Route 56 North and we continued on. This stretch of road was real wilderness, and I said to Kate, "This looks like Indian country. What's it say in the brochure about Indians?" "Friendly?" "It says that the peace treaty with the Native American population expires on Columbus Day 2002. "Funny." We drove for about 20 miles, and a brown sign informed us that we were leaving Adirondack State Park. Kate said, "The desk sergeant said the Custer Hill Club is on private land inside the park, so we passed it." She glanced at the Hertz map. "There's a town called South Colton a few miles up ahead. We'll stop and ask for directions." I continued on, and a small group of buildings appeared. A sign said, "South Colton, a small town with a big chip on its shoulder," or words to that effect. There was a gas station at the edge of the small bump-in-the-road town, and I pulled in and parked. I said to Kate, "You go ask for directions."
"John, get off your ass and go ask for directions."
"All right. You come with me." We got out, stretched, and went inside the small rustic office. A wizened old guy from Central Casting, wearing jeans and a plaid shirt, sat at a beat-up desk, smoking a cigarette and watching a fly-fishing show on a TV that was on the counter. Reception seemed to be less than optimum, so I moved the rabbit ears for him, and he said, "Right there. That's good." As soon as I took my hands off the rabbit ears, he lost reception again. One of my jobs as a kid used to be to act as an antenna for the family television, but I was beyond that now, and I said to him, "We need some directions."
"I need to get a satellite dish."
"Not a bad idea. You can speak directly to the mothership." "We're looking for..."
"Where you coming from?"
"Saranac Lake."
"Yeah?"
He looked us over for the first time, checked out the Taurus outside, and asked,
"Where are you from?"
"Earth. Look, we're running late.
Need gas?"
"Sure. But first..."
"Lady, need the restroom?"
Kate answered, "Thank you. We're headed for the Custer Hill Club." He didn't reply for a few seconds, then said,
"Yeah?
You know where that is?"
"Sure do. They gas up here.
Don't do no car work for them.
They take their cars up to the dealer in Potsdam."
"Hell. I forgot more about car repair than those idiots at the dealers ever knew." He went on, "But if they get stuck in the snow or mud, who do you think they call?"
"The dealer?"
"Hell no. They call Rudy. That's me."
"Why, just last January, or maybe it was February."
"Yeah, it was that big snow in mid-month. You remember that?" I replied, "I may have been in Barbados. Look, Rudy, I got a snack machine over there and a Coke machine. You need change?" I surrendered. "Yes, please." So we got change, bought some petrified snacks from the machine, plus two Cokes, used the restroom, and got a few gallons of gas. Back in the tiny office, I paid for the gas with one of my government MasterCards. Agents carry two credit cards. One for food, lodging, and miscellaneous, and one specifically for gasoline. My gasoline card said corporate and R&I Associates, which meant nothing, but nosy Rudy asked, "What's R&I Associates?" "Refrigerators and ice makers."
"Yeah?"
I changed the subject and asked him, "You got a local map?"
"Nope, but I can draw you one."
"For free?" He laughed and rummaged through a stack of junk mail and found a flyer advertising a moose wrestling contest or something and began writing on the back with a pencil. He said, "So you gotta look for Stark Road first and make a left, but there's no signs. Then you get to Joe Indian Road."
"Excuse me?
Joe Indian." He went through it again in case I was stupid, then concluded, "You hit this here logging road with no name and stay on for about 10 miles. Now, you're looking for McEwen Pond Road on the left, and that takes you right up to the Custer Hill property. Can't miss it, because you get stopped.
Stopped by who?
The guards. They got a house there and a gate. The whole property got a fence around it.
Okay. Thanks, Rudy.
Why are you heading up there?
We're doing a service call for the refrigerator. Problem with the ice maker.
Yeah?
He looked at us.
They expecting you?
They sure are. They can't make a cocktail until we fix the ice problem.
They didn't give you no directions?
They did, but my dog ate them.
Okay, thanks. Hey, you want some advice?
Sure.
I gotta warn you, but you didn't hear it from me.
Okay.
Get your money up front. They's slow paying.
That's the way the rich are.
Slow paying the working people.
Thanks for the warning.
We left, and I said to Kate, we're on candid camera, right?
I'm starting to think so.
We got in the car and doubled back on Route 56, entered the park, and kept an eye out for Stark Road. I found it and turned on to this narrow road, which ran through a tunnel of trees.
You want some beef jerky?
No, thank you. And don't litter.
I was hungry enough to eat a bear, but I settled for the beef jerky, which was gross. I threw the cellophane wrappers in the rear seat, my contribution to ecology.
We were close to the Custer Hill Club, and according to Walsh, an air and land search was supposed to be underway around the club property, but I didn't hear any helicopters or fixed-wing aircraft, and I didn't see any police search vehicles around. This was not a good sign, or it was a very good sign.
Kate checked her cell phone and said,
I have service now, and I also have a message.
She started to retrieve the message, but I said, we're out of contact. No messages. No calls.
What if they've found Harry?
I don't want to know either way. We're going to see Bain Maddox. She put her cell phone back in her pocket, then her beeper went off, and so did mine a minute later. We followed Rudy's directions, and within 20 minutes, we turned onto McEwen Pond Road, which was narrow but well paved. There was a big sign up ahead that stretched above the road, fixed to 2 10-foot poles with floodlights attached. The sign said, "This is private property. No trespassing. Stop at gate ahead or turn around." We passed under the sign, and ahead I could see a clearing where a rustic log house stood behind a closed steel security gate. Two men in camouflage fatigues exited the house as though they knew we were coming long before we got to the gate, and I said to Kate, motion or sound detectors. Maybe TV cameras, too.
Not to mention those guys are wearing holsters, and one of them is looking at us with binoculars.
God, how I hate private security guys. Give them a gun and some power, and
that sign says slow down to 5 miles an hour.
I slowed down and approached the closed gate. 10 feet from the gate was a speed bump and a sign that said, stop here. I stopped. The gate, which was electric, slid open a few feet, and one of the guys walked toward our car. I lowered the window, and he came up to me and asked, how can I help you? The guy was in his 30s, all decked out in military camis, hat, boots, and gun. He also wore an expression suggesting he was very cool and possibly dangerous if provoked. All he needed to complete the look were sunglasses and a swastika. I said to him, I'm Federal Agent John Corey, and this is Federal Agent Kate Mayfield. We're here to see Mr. Bain Maddox. This seemed to crack his stone face, and he asked, is he expecting you? If he was, you'd know about it, wouldn't you? Can I see some identification? I wanted to show him my Glock first so he knew he wasn't the only person carrying, but to be nice, I handed him my credentials, and so did Kate. He studied both sets of credentials, and I had the feeling he either recognized them as legitimate or was pretending he was well-versed in credential recognition. I interrupted his perusal of the creds. I'll take those back. He hesitated, then handed them to us. I reiterated, "We're here to see Mr. Maddox on official business." "What is the nature of your business? Are you Mr. Maddox?"
"No,
but..." "Look, fella, you've got about 10 seconds to do something brilliant. Call ahead if you need to, then open the fucking gates." He looked a little pissed, but kept his cool and said, "Hold on." He went back to the gate, slipped through the opening, and spoke to the other guy. Then they both disappeared into the log gatehouse. Kate asked me, "Why do you always need to be confrontational?" "Confrontational is when I pull my gun. Argumentative is when I pull the trigger. Federal agents are trained to be polite." "I missed that class."
"What if they don't let us in?"
"They can refuse us access to private property if we don't have a search warrant."
"Where's it say that?"
"It's actually in the Constitution."
$10 says we get in."
"You're on." The neo-fascist came back to our car and said, "I'm going to ask you to pull up through the gate and park your car to the right. A jeep will take you up to the lodge."
"Why can't I take my own car?"
"It's for your own safety and security, sir, and because of our insurance policy."
"Well, we don't want to mess with your insurance company."
"Hey, you have bears on the property?"
"Yes, sir."
"Please proceed through the gate and remain in your vehicle until the jeep arrives."
Did this idiot think I was getting out with bears around?
He signaled to the guy at the gatehouse, and the steel gate slid open. I drove into the property and turned onto a gravel patch. The gate slid closed behind us, and I said to Kate, "Welcome to the Custer Hill Club. You owe me $10. She joked, "20 says we don't get out of here alive." A black jeep with tinted windows approached. It stopped, and two guys wearing holsters and camouflage fatigues got out and came toward us. I said, "I need odds." One guy came up to my window and said, "Please exit and follow me." This seemed like the kind of place where someone would put a tracking device or a bug in your car, so I had no intention of leaving the car there. I said, "I have a better idea. You lead, I'll follow." He hesitated, then replied, "Follow me closely and stay on the road."
"If you stay on the road, I'll stay on the road."
He went back to the jeep and turned around, and I followed him up a hill through a cleared field with big rock outcroppings. Kate said, "I assume you didn't want them installing unwanted options in the car. When you see this level of security, you need to be as paranoid as they are."
"You always know how to handle a bad situation that you've gotten us into."
"Thank you, I think." The road was lined with pole lights, and I also noticed a series of utility poles running from the tree line across the open field and into the next tree line. The poles carried 5 wires, and as we passed beneath them, I saw that 3 of the wires were actually thick cables that must have been major power lines. About halfway up the hill, I could see a huge lodge, the size of a small hotel. In the front of the lodge was a tall pole flying the American flag, and below the flag flew a yellow pennant of some sort. Beyond the lodge at the top of the hill, I saw a tall tower that looked like a cellular relay tower, which explained why we had reception here, and why Harry should have reception if he was alive and well. I wondered if this tower belonged to the phone company or to Bain Maddox. We reached the lodge, in front of which was a gravel parking space where another black jeep was parked, along with a blue Ford Taurus, like the one I was driving. But this Taurus had an E sticker on the rear bumper, which I knew meant it was an Enterprise rental car. So maybe some weekend guests were still here. Also parked was a dark blue van, probably the same one that Betty had mentioned. We stopped under the big, columned portico, and both guys got out and opened our doors. Kate and I exited, she carrying a briefcase stuffed with airline manifests and car rental agreements. I made a mental note of the plate number on the Enterprise car, then locked our doors and looked around. The area surrounding the lodge was clear for about a half mile on all sides, which made for good views and very good security. Harry would have had a tough time getting close enough to this park and field to photograph plates and people, even if he used the rock formations for cover. Also, I'd counted 4 security guys so far, and I had a feeling there were more. This place was tight, and I was fairly sure now that Harry had walked into a bad situation. The Jeep driver said to us, "Please follow me." I warned him, "No one is to touch this car. If I discover that anyone has added an unwanted feature to this car, he's going to jail. Understood?" He didn't reply, but he understood. We climbed a few steps to the covered veranda, where a row of Adirondack chairs and rockers faced out toward the sweeping view down the hill. Aside from the security goons, this was a very pleasant and homey place. I noticed now that the yellow pennant had the number 7 on it. The security guy said, "Please wait here," and disappeared into the lodge. Kate and I stood on the porch, and I speculated, maybe this place is for sale. Comes with a small army. She didn't respond to that, and instead said to me,
"I should check my messages."
"No."
"John, what if..."
"No. This is one of those rare times when I don't want any new information. We're going to see Bane Maddox." She looked at me and nodded. The door opened and the security guy said, "Come in." We entered the Custer Hill Club. Chapter 22. We walked into a large atrium lobby with a balcony above and a massive chandelier made of deer antlers. The room was paneled in yellow pine and decorated in a rustic style with hooked rugs, hunting and fishing prints, and a few pieces of furniture made of tree branches. I had the feeling that Mrs. Maddox, if there was one, had nothing to do with this lodge. I said to Kate, "Nice place." She replied, "I'm sure there's a moose head around here somewhere." We heard footsteps coming from a passageway to the left, and a different security guy. This one, a middle-aged man dressed in blue, entered the lobby. This must have been one of the palace guards, and he introduced himself to us as Carl. He asked, "May I take your coats?" We said we'd keep them, and then he addressed Kate. "May I put your briefcase in the coat room?"
"I'll carry it."
He said to her, "For security reasons, I'll need to look in your briefcase."
"Forget it."
This seemed to put him off, and he asked us, "What is the nature of your business with Mr. Maddox?" I said, "Look, Carl, we're federal agents, and we don't submit to searches, and we're not checking anything, including our guns, and we don't answer questions, we ask them. You can either take us in to see Bane Maddox now, or we'll be back with a search warrant, 10 more federal agents, and the state police. How do you want to do this?" Carl seemed unsure, so he said, "Let me find out." He left. Kate whispered in my ear,
$10 says we get in to see the wizard."
"No, you're not getting your money back after I bullied him into one choice." I took my cell phone out of my pocket, unhooked the beeper from my belt, and turned them both off. I said to Kate, "These things sometimes spook a suspect, or break up an interview at a critical moment." I informed her, "This is one of the times we're allowed to kill the beeper."
"I'm not so sure about that, but..."
Reluctantly, she turned off her phone and beeper. I noticed a large oil painting on the far wall. It was a scene of the Battle of the Little Bighorn, General George Armstrong Custer and his men, surrounded by painted Indians on horseback, and it looked like the Indians were still winning. I said to Kate, "Did you ever see that painting of Custer's Last Stand in the Museum of Modern Art?"
"No. Did you?"
"I did. It's sort of abstract and reminds me of Magritte or Dali." She didn't reply, wondering, I'm sure, how I knew Magritte or Dali, or when I was ever in a museum. I continued, The painting shows this fish with a big eye and a halo, floating in air, and underneath the fish are all these Native Americans having sex.
What? What does that have to do with Custer's Last Stand?
Well, the painting is titled, Holy Mackerel, Look at All Those Fucking Indians. No response. Get it? Fish, big eye, halo, holy mackerel, look at...
That is the stupidest joke I've ever heard.
Carl reappeared and said to us, Please follow me. We followed him down a hallway into what looked like a library, then continued down a few steps into a huge cathedral-ceilinged room. At the far end of the room was a big stone fireplace, logs blazing away, and a big moose head over the mantel. I said to Kate, Hey, there's your moose head. How did you know? Anyway, sitting in a winged chair near the fire was a man. He stood and crossed the big room, and I saw he was wearing a blue blazer, tan slacks, and a green plaid shirt. We met halfway, and he extended his hand to Kate, who took it. He said, I'm Bane Maddox, president and owner of this club, and you must be Ms. Mayfield.
Welcome. Thank you.
He turned to me, extended his hand, and said, And you are Mr. Corey. We shook, and he asked me, So, how can I help you? I remembered my politeness class and replied, First, I'd like to thank you for seeing us without an appointment. He smiled tightly. What were my choices? Pretty limited, actually. I took stock of Mr. Bane Maddox. He was maybe mid-50s, tall, fit, and not bad-looking. He sported long gray hair swept back from a smooth forehead, and he had a prominent hooked nose and steely gray eyes that hardly blinked. He sort of reminded me of a hawk or an eagle, and in fact, his head jerked now and then like a bird's. He also had a cultured voice, as you'd expect. And beyond the outward appearances, I sensed a very cool and confident man. We looked at each other, trying, I'm sure, to determine who was the real alpha male with the biggest dick. I said to him, We need about 10 minutes of your time. Maybe a bit more, but you always say 10. I nodded toward the chairs by the fire. He hesitated, then said, Well, you must have had a long journey. Come, have a seat. We followed him back across the room, and Carl tagged along. I could see lots of dead animal heads on the walls and stuffed birds, which is not politically correct these days, but I was sure that Bane Maddox didn't give a shit. I half expected to see a stuffed Democrat on the wall. I also noticed a big wooden gun cabinet with glass doors, through which I could see about a dozen rifles and shotguns. Maddox motioned us to two leather wing-back chairs facing him across a coffee table, and we all sat. Bane Maddox, now feeling compelled to be a good host, asked us, Can I have Carl bring you something? Coffee? Tea? He motioned toward a glass of amber liquid on the table. Something stronger? Kate, following the procedure for keeping someone sitting longer than they may have wanted to sit and chat, said, Coffee, please. I wanted a scotch, and I could actually smell Maddox's scotch in his glass, which he was drinking straight up. So maybe there really was a problem with the ice maker.
Mr. Corey?
You know, I'm really dying for a latte. Can you do that? He looked at Carl and said, Ask in the kitchen if we can get a latte. Or a cappuccino, I said. Even an Americano will do. Maybe a mocha freezy. I don't drink this shit, of course, but we needed some time with Mr. Maddox. Carl left, and I now noticed the dog lying on its side between Maddox's chair and the hearth, sleeping or dead. Maddox informed me, That's Kaiser Wilhelm. Looks like a dog. He smiled. It's a Doberman. Very smart, loyal, strong, and fast. Hard to believe. I mean, the stupid dog was just lying there, slobbering on the rug, snoring and farting. Kate said, "He's a beautiful animal." Oh, and it had a boner. I wondered what he was dreaming about. Also, Ms. Mayfield doesn't think I'm so beautiful when I'm snoring, slobbering, or farting. "So," asked Mr. Maddox, "what can I do for you?" Normally, Kate and I would have already discussed who was going to lead and what we were after. However, what we were after, Harry Muller, would tip off Mr. Maddox that he was under surveillance, so this limited our questions to the weather and the World Series. On the other hand, maybe Maddox already knew he is under surveillance. "Mr. Corey? Ms. Mayfield?" I made the decision to follow the example of General Custer and charge ahead, hopefully with better results. I told him, "We're acting on information that a federal agent by the name of Harry Muller disappeared in the vicinity of this club, and we believe he may be lost on your property or hurt." I searched his face for a reaction, but his only expression seemed to be one of concern. "Here? On this property?" "Possibly." He seemed truly surprised, or he was a good actor. He said to me, "But, as you saw, it's not easy to get onto this property." He was on foot. "Oh? But this property is posted and surrounded by a security fence." It was my turn to feign surprise, and I replied, "A fence? Really? Well, maybe he got through the fence." "Why would he do that?" "Good question. He's a fanatical bird watcher." "I see. So you think he may have gotten through the fence and wound up on this property?" "Possibly." Maddox's demeanor remained concerned and perplexed.
"But why do you think that?
There are millions of acres of wilderness surrounding this property. I have only about 16,000 acres."
"Is that all?"
"Look, Mr. Maddox, we're acting on specific information, which we need to check out. My question to you is, have you or your staff seen or encountered anyone on the property?" He shook his head and replied, "I would have been told." He asked me, "How long has this man been missing?"
"Since Saturday, but it has just come to our attention."
He nodded thoughtfully and took a sip of his scotch. "Well," he said, "I had about 16 house guests this weekend, many of whom were hiking or bird hunting, plus I have security staff, so it's unlikely that this person could have been lost on my property without someone coming across him."
Kate spoke for the first time and pointed out, 16 people divided into 16,000 acres is one person per 1,000 acres. You could hide an army in there."
Mr. Maddox thought about the arithmetic and replied, "I suppose if he were hurt and unable to move, it may be possible that he wouldn't have been discovered."
Kate said, "Very possible."
Maddox lit a cigarette and blew smoke rings into the air.
"What," he asked, "would you like me to do?
How can I help?"
I regarded Bain Maddox, smoking, drinking, sitting in his leather chair in his big lodge. He looked more at ease than the average suspect. Actually, he looked innocent. I had the feeling, however, that even if he had something to do with Harry's disappearance, this man would keep his cool. He could easily have told his flunkies to tell us he wasn't in or wasn't available. Instead, he'd chosen to meet us face to face. My brief forays into criminal psychology and my years on the street taught me about sociopaths and narcissists. Incredibly egotistical and arrogant people who thought they could get away with murder by bullshitting. It was quite possible that Bain Maddox had something to hide, and he thought he could hide it under my nose. That wasn't going to happen. He repeated, "How can I help?" I replied, "We'd like your permission to conduct a search on your property." He seemed prepared for that and said,
I can conduct my own search now that I know there may be someone lost on the property. I have about 15 staff available, plus all-terrain vehicles and 6 jeeps. I pointed out it would take you a month to cover this property. I'm talking about state and local police, federal agents, and maybe troops from Fort Drum. He didn't seem to like that idea, but he was boxed in. So he asked me, "Tell me again why you think this man is on my property and not out in the surrounding wilderness." That was a really good question, and I had a standard law enforcement answer. "We are acting on information and belief, and that's all I can say." I pointed out, with the information we have, we could get a search warrant, but that takes time. "We'd rather have your voluntary cooperation." "Is there a problem with that?" "No, no problem. But I suggest you begin with an aerial search, which can do the same job more quickly and just as effectively." Kate said, "Thank you. We know that. We have begun the air search. We're here to get your permission to enter this property with search teams." "I certainly won't stand in the way of a search for a missing person." He paused. "But I'll need a liability waiver." Kate was becoming annoyed and said, "We'll have one faxed to you ASAP." "Thank you. I don't want to sound like a bad citizen, but unfortunately we live in litigious times." I couldn't argue with that, and I said to him, "The country is going to hell. Too many lawyers." He nodded and offered his opinion, saying, "Lawyers are ruining the country. Ruining trust, frightening people who want to be good Samaritans, promoting a culture of victimization, and engaging in legalized extortion." I liked this guy and agreed. "In fact, they suck." He smiled. "They suck." I thought I should inform him, "Ms. Mayfield is a lawyer." "Oh. Well, I apologize if I..." She said, "I don't practice law." "Good," he said, then joked, "You look too nice to be a lawyer." Ms. Mayfield stared at Mr. Maddox. Mr. Maddox said, "I assume you'll begin the search in the morning?" He pointed out, "It's getting too dark now to send people into those woods." Clearly Mr. Maddox was stalling for time with all the bullshit about liability waivers and so forth. I said, "I think we have about 3 hours of daylight left. I'll have my staff begin a search immediately. They know the terrain." We looked at each other, and those freaky gray eyes never blinked. Without taking his eyes off me, he said, "Mr. Corey, please tell me why a federal agent was on my property." I already had the answer to that. The fact that Mr. Mueller is a federal agent is actually irrelevant.
Irrelevant?
Yes. He was on a camping trip. Not on duty. Was I not clear about that?
Perhaps I misunderstood.
Perhaps. I added, "And since he is a federal agent, the federal government is assisting in the search."
"I see.
So I shouldn't make too much of you and Ms. Mayfield being with the anti-terrorist task force?"
"No.
In fact, you shouldn't make anything of it." I added, "I should have also mentioned that Mr. Mueller is a colleague, so we're here out of personal concern, as well as for professional reasons." He thought a moment, then said, "I haven't experienced that kind of camaraderie since I left the army. If I were missing, I couldn't think of a single person who would do much more than make a few phone calls to find me."
"Not even your mom?"
He smiled. "Well, maybe her. And maybe my children in good time. Certainly the Internal Revenue Service would come looking for me after I missed a quarterly payment." Neither Kate nor I commented on that. Maddox lit another cigarette and blew more smoke rings, saying, "That's a lost art." He asked us, "May I offer you a cigarette?" We refused his offer. I glanced around the room and noticed something in a dark corner staring at me with glassy eyes. It was actually a huge black bear, standing on its hind legs with its front legs and paws raised in a threatening gesture. I mean, I knew it was dead and stuffed, but it gave me a little jolt. I said to Maddox, "Did you shoot that?"
"I did."
"Where?"
"Here, on my property. Sometimes they get through the fence."
"And you shoot them?"
"Well, if it's off-season, we just tranquilize them and relocate them."
"Why do you ask?"
"I don't like bears."
"Have you had a bad experience?"
"No, I'm trying to avoid a bad experience."
"Hey, do you think a 9mm Glock will stop a bear?"
"I don't think so, and I hope you don't have to find out."
"Me too."
"Do you have bear traps on the property?"
"Definitely not. I have guests on the property, and I don't want them caught in a bear trap." He added, "Also, trespassers. I could get sued." He glanced at his watch and said, "So if..." "Just a few more questions while we wait for the latte." He didn't reply, and I asked him, "So you're a hunter?"
"I hunt."
"These are all your trophies?"
"Yes. I don't buy them, as some people do."
"So, you're a pretty good shot."
"I was an expert rifleman in the army, and I can still drop a deer at 200 yards.
"That's pretty good. How close was that bear?"
"Close. I let the predators get close."
He looked at me, and I had the feeling he was being subtly unsubtle regarding yours truly. He said, "That's what makes it exciting." He asked me, "What does this have to do with Mr. Muller's disappearance?"
"Not a thing."
We stared at each other while he waited for me to explain my line of questioning. I said to him, "Just making conversation." I then asked him, "So, this is a private club?"
"It is."
"Could I join? I'm white, Irish, and English. Catholic, like Christopher Columbus, but I could switch. I got married in a Methodist church." Mr. Maddox informed me there are no such requirements or exclusions, but our membership is filled at the moment. Kate asked, "Do you accept women?" He smiled. "Personally, I do, but club membership is restricted to men."
"Why is that?"
"Because that's the way I want it." Carl appeared carrying a tray, which he set down on the coffee table. He said to me, "Is a cafe au lait all right?"
"Terrific."
He indicated a small silver coffee pot for Ms. Mayfield, then asked us, "Will that be all?" We nodded, and Carl disappeared. Mr. Maddox went to the sideboard to refresh his scotch, and I said, "I'll have a small one." He replied over his shoulder, "You'll have to take it neat." He poured two glasses, turned around, and remarked, "I seem to be having trouble with my ice maker." He smiled. "Rudy, you old shit, I'm gonna shove those rabbit ears up your ass." More important, Maddox knew someone was on the way to see him, yet he'd made no attempt to avoid his unknown visitors, even after the gatehouse goons told him we were federal agents. Obviously, he'd made the decision to check us out while we checked him out. Maddox handed me a crystal glass and said, "Happy Columbus Day." We touched glasses, then he sat, crossed his legs, sipped, and stared at the fire. Kaiser Wilhelm woke up and snuggled next to his master's chair to get his ears scratched. The stupid dog stared at me, and I stared back. He looked away first, so I won. Kate sipped her coffee, then broke the silence.
"You said you had 16 guests this weekend."
"That's correct." Maddox again glanced at his watch. "I believe they're all gone by now." Kate informed him, "We may need to speak to them, so I'll need their names and contact information." Maddox didn't see that coming and was momentarily speechless, which I guess was not usual for him. "Why?"
"In the event they saw or heard something related to Mr. Muller's disappearance," she added, "standard procedure."
He didn't seem to like this standard procedure.
"That seems totally unnecessary. No one saw or heard anything. Also, please understand this is a private club whose members wish to remain private. Kate replied, I can ensure their privacy, and it's up to us to determine if anyone saw or heard anything.
He took a bigger sip of scotch and said to Kate, I'm not an attorney, as you are, but it's my understanding that unless this is a criminal matter, which it is not, or a civil case, which it is not, then I don't need to give you the names of my house guests any more than you need to give me the names of your house guests. I couldn't resist and said, I had my aunt and uncle, Joe and Agnes O'Leary, over last weekend. Who'd you have? He looked at me, and I couldn't tell if he appreciated me or not.